You got this. Good morning, members. I'd like to bring the Environment, Natural Resources, Policy, and Finance Committee to order. Representative Green, if you could move the minutes of February 9th.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the minutes.
Discussion to the minutes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Minutes are adopted. Representative Moline, welcome and thank you for carrying this really important bill as we move forward, an issue that's affecting all of us. That was the wake-up call for everybody, so we're good to go. So, members, we've got laid out a number of folks speaking, and we're going to really watch the time because I want to let everybody get through this. Representative Moline, I'm going to move your bill that it be laid over for possible inclusion, and then we'll decide if we also move it separate or not. But we do need to move this discussion forward. It's been stalemated, and it's going to have devastating effect on our state if we don't find a good solution. So welcome and begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members, for hearing House File 1000 today. I appreciate you taking the time to consider this very important bill. Mr. Chair, I'm going to be relatively brief in my comments because I know that we have a number of testifiers here who want to be heard on the record and provide valuable information to committee members. Just to start out with a brief history of the sulfate standard, the 10 milligrams per liter standard for discharge into wild rice waters, that was adopted into a rule in 1973. It was not enforced until around 2010. So no permits that were issued between 1973 until around 2010 had that standard in it. The MPCA did start to require that standard in around 2010. To meet the 10-part standard for discharge into wild rice waters. In 2011, and Mr. Chair, you'll remember because you were instrumental in helping pass that legislation, we tried to address the issue of how the wild rice sulfate standard would operate in regard to our industry and municipality and those who discharge into wild rice waters. What we did at that time in 2011 was require the MPCA to address water quality standards for water containing wild rice, designate each body of water or specific portion to which wild rice water quality standards apply, and designate the specific time the wild rice water quality standards apply. The final language that came out of 2011 created an advisory group to provide input, the study and possible revision to the standard. Forbid any expenditures on design or implementation of sulfate treatment to the extent allowable by the Clean Water Act, and did not prevent the MPCA from including a schedule of compliance requiring the standard. Unfortunately now, Mr. Chair, I did not anticipate that I would be in front of you in 2015 still talking about rulemaking for designating wild rice waters. I think it was under our assumption in 2011 that they would begin that process right away and that it would be done at this time. Unfortunately, that process in designating the wild rice waters has not yet begun and will be at least a two-year process from now. We were informed that the MPCA will continue to impose the 10 standard on facilities, the discharge, despite the fact that waters haven't been designated yet, and despite the fact that the science is showing that there is no justification for the 10 standard. And so, Mr. Chair and members, what this bill does is simply says that the MPCA needs to start the rulemaking process and complete the rulemaking process for designating wild rice waters and specific times of year in which the standard applies before they can require this 10 standard in permits. So it suspends the standard for the purpose of rulemaking being completed. And Mr. Chair, just one more thing to mention is you know, I want to anticipate that there are some that are going to testify that the standard is about protecting wild rice. And protecting wild rice is a universal goal. But what we've seen is that the science that's coming out does not support the 10 standard. It was not enforced from 1973 until 2010. And, you know, the own research that was done by the University of Minnesota for the MPCA has indicated that a much higher standard is appropriate for protecting wild rice. So we're simply asking the MPCA to do what we had asked them to do in 2011 by completing the rulemaking process before they impose this standard on industry or municipality or anyone discharging into wild rice waters. And so, Mr. Chair, I don't know if you want to go to questions now for me or if you want to continue with the testifiers.
Representative Moline, we will go to questions for you. I want to clarify, members and to the audience, I noted that the bill is being laid over and we may consider at a later date that the bill may move on its own. That will only be with another hearing. We will not be moving the bill out of here today anywhere other than to be laid over. Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that was kind of my question was on process, because I know and I think there was some reference to Representative Metza had a similar bill that was referred to the another committee. Is that bill going to be moving as well, or will this bill have to go to that committee, or will that bill have to come to this committee? Could you maybe just give us a roadmap because they're very similar?
Thank you, Representative Hanson. I anticipate we'll hear from Representative Hackbarth before the committee's over to his understanding. But because of the similarities in the bills, I think it'll work well if each one of those bills potentially could be heard in each committee. And my conversation with Representative Hackbarth, he intends to hear bills that are in his committee. So why don't we leave that question up to Representative Hackbarth when he gets here. Additional questions for Representative Moline? Thank you, Representative Moline. Why don't we Representative Dill. And Representative Dill, you could have moved the bill too. If I'm not mistaken, you're one of the top co-authors. So I think we're both on the bill. So
thank you,
Representative Dill.
I just want to make sure I understand that the standard was in place in 73, as we know, through 2010, and there was the standard was ignored. It was never applied in any permits so that it could be enforced. And then suddenly in 2010, there was an epiphany, and things started to happen in its enforcement. Do you know, or should I ask the PCA, how that could possibly happen, to go all of that time and just ignore something that's obviously so important to so many people?
Representative Moline, or we will have PCA there at the tail end of all the presenters. Representative Moline.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative Dill, I know the PCA is wanting to be heard today regarding the bill, but from my understanding, it was put into rule in 1973 based on some fieldwork studies conducted in the 1940s primarily, put into rule in 1973, was not enforced until 2010. In my discussions, which I'm remembering back from 2011 with the PCA, was basically it was a forgotten rule. Nobody had brought it to their attention and asked them to enforce it until around 2010 when groups brought it to the attention of the PCA and asked them to enforce it. But until that time, from 1973 till 2010, it was not recognized or enforced or put in any permits by the PCA.
Representative Dill.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I thought that's the reason we had rulemaking, and that's what I'll be asking the PCA is how, I mean, if that's the case, we should have bucks only season, but ignore the fact that people are shooting antlerless deer, and they don't enforce that either, the DNR. So I find it very strange that suddenly there's this epiphany that this all thing has to come before us, and there has to be so much emotion, and I find it interesting that it certainly came about during the era of the beginning of polymath. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any comment, Representative Moline?
No, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Moline. I'm interested in kind of the calendar, the chronology from 2011. Maybe my memory's a little foggy, but so the legislature passed the 2011 requirement for a study. That was during the special session when we were meeting in July. Is that right?
Representative Moline? Recollection?
Mr. Chair, I don't remember if it was in the regular session or a special session.
Okay.
I don't recall that.
Representative Hansen, follow-up.
And Mr. Chair, so then the PCA put together a working group, and did they finish their work like in 2013? Didn't they have a timeline to finish their work to do a report back to us or something? Was that in like 2013 they had to?
Representative Moline?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen, yes, I believe that's correct. You know, my understanding in reading the language of the 2011 law was that the rulemaking process on designating wild rice water and what the criteria is for what is a wild rice water would have been started at that point. I certainly didn't anticipate that it wouldn't be starting in 2015 and we'd be looking at 2017 or even early 2018 where we would have a final rule on what is a wild rice water. You know, the industry and municipalities need predictability, and, you know, unfortunately, when they don't even know what is a wild rice water, it's really hard for them to plan their treatment facilities. So, yes, there was a timeline in place, but, and I know it's taken longer than the PCA anticipated as well to get all the studies in, but, you know, we didn't anticipate at that time that they wouldn't have been starting the rulemaking process on for designating wild rice waters yet.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Moline, was that study like done in January, February last year? And then is this the one that kind of got stopped or action stopped being taken on it, or it wasn't released, or seemed, I'm trying to remember, there was some controversy about this supposed to be coming out and then it wasn't? Or?
Representative Hansen, some of those questions may be better for MPCA if you want to just address these specific questions with them now. Otherwise, their intent was to come after the public testifier. So I'll leave that up to you, Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, I'm trying to ask the author of the bill because I'm trying to understand. Sometimes my memory gets a little foggy, but we required a report, and then the report got done, and then it didn't come out, or it's still being worked on, or I'm trying to understand why the delay.
Representative Hansen, the commissioner got cold feet, you're right, and so we're at a kind of a stall point here. Representative Moline.
Well, I mean, Mr. Chair, just for clarity, this has been a very public process. There was no studying that was ever halted. I think that when the scientific research on how wild rice responds to sulfates and the different environmental factors that happen in nature, once they started really getting in deep in the research, they realized it was a much more complex issue than simply how does wild rice respond to sulfates. And so there was additional studies that needed to take place, and it has taken the PCA more time than they anticipated. And it has certainly taken more time than we ever anticipated. But there was never a halt to the study. It's been a very public process as far as the research goes from the state standpoint.
Representative Hansen, okay. Members, what I plan to do is I'll announce, and if I'm not mistaken, if any of these testifiers, if their time in their discussion with Ms. Sipko was different than what I announced, let me know, because I want to make sure we get through everybody. I've got about 70 minutes allocated for testimony, and it's various on your testimony. Mr. Quillis, I understand you're going to take about 2 minutes, and next on deck is Mr. Kurt Anderson, so if you want to be ready. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Mr. Quillis, if you could identify yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tony Quillis, and I'm the Director of Environmental Policy at the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, and I have with me Mr. Anderson from Minnesota Power. And I will be brief, but I wanted to let you know how important this issue is to the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce and the business community in general. Mr. Chairman, in your packets and members is a colored map that looks like this. And that map was put together at the request of the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce by Bar Engineering, and it has a couple of components to it. The first part is, in 2007, the legislature requested the DNR to put together a list of location and estimated acreage of natural wild rice stands in the state of Minnesota. So that was what was superimposed onto this map at first. The second overlay of that is we asked the Pollution Control Agency for all their NPDES permits, the National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System permits, and we put those along with the waters that they discharge into onto this map. And this shows and illustrates why this issue is so important to the business community. Mr. Chairman, if you'll look down on the bottom left-hand side down there at the potential locations that are affected there, there are 673 dischargers that are potentially affected, ranging from agricultural processing facilities, industrial facilities, the DNR, municipal facilities, as well as tribal facilities. And that is why this is a statewide issue, and that's why it is very important to the Minnesota business community. We are directly affected either through possessing an NPDES permit or indirectly when one of our facilities discharges into somebody like a wastewater treatment plant that has an NPDES permit. Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to make sure that you are aware of that's why it is so important to the Minnesota business community. I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Anderson for his comments, but I also wanted to let you know that there is a letter in your packets from the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities and the League of Minnesota Cities, and I think you're going to hear from some city council members right after us on how it's important to them also, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Kullis.
Thank you for the time. Stand for any questions, but I'm here every day, Mr. Chairman, whether you want to do it later today or not. It's up to you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Mr. Kullis, and to everyone, we're going to take all the testimony from everybody. As I said, there's 70 minutes allocated for testimony, and then we will do questions after that. So if you could keep your questions and note who they're for, that would be good, and we'll come back to that. If for some reason we don't finish today, we'll be back here tomorrow morning. Welcome, Mr. Anderson. I understand you have 10 minutes for your testimony. If you don't use it all, that's okay. If you could identify yourself for the record. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and representatives. My name is Kurt Anderson, and I'm the manager of environmental and land management for Minnesota Power. My background is in water quality management and aquatic toxicology, and I have extensive experience evaluating and implementing different elements of the Federal Clean Water Act and Minnesota Water Quality Rules. As a professional water quality scientist, I am committed to sound science and a fully established regulatory process. I am pleased to be with you today to provide my perspectives about this legislation and why it is so important for the citizens of the state of Minnesota. Before I discuss this legislation, I want to add some context to the historical standard. In the 1930s and 40s, Dr. John Moyle from the Minnesota DNR conducted a series of field observations throughout Minnesota, collecting data on wild rice and sulfate levels from different water bodies. This research took place from the prairie parkland regions of southwestern Minnesota, where sulfate is naturally low, to northeastern Minnesota, where sulfate is naturally low. Dr. Moyle did not measure other factors that are typically known to affect the abundance of wild rice, such as landscape types or soils, competing species, water flows or weather, all of which can be markedly different as one moves from the prairie to the northern forest. However, based on this research, Dr. Moyle then concluded, wild rice is generally absent when sulfate levels exceed 50 milligrams per liter, and that no large stands of rice occurred in water with more than 10 milligrams per liter. However, the key word here is generally absent. Moyle noted that wild rice was observed in water containing over 250 milligrams per liter of sulfate. Research conducted by other scientists in the 1960s and 70s showed that sulfate's effect on wild rice might range from 60 milligrams per liter up to 500 milligrams per liter. Laboratory research conducted by University of Saskatchewan in 1968 showed that wild rice grew in lake bottom sediments with levels of sulfate at 1,500 milligrams per liter, or 150 times the current standard. Despite the uncertainty around the specific sulfate number, Minnesota adopted the 10 milligram per liter water quality rulemaking in 1973. In 1975, the first attempt to apply the standard took place at Minnesota Power's Boswell Energy Center in Cohasset, Minnesota. However, after administrative hearings, the sulfate standard was set to 40 milligrams per liter from April 15th to June 15th, when wild rice was considered more sensitive to sulfate, and 60 milligrams per liter the rest of the year, so 4 to 6 times the current standard. Until 2010, no other Minnesota permits contained sulfate limits to protect wild rice. In fact, in 2009, MPCA staff responding to a survey from the Iowa DNR stated that they, quote, believe there is little scientific justification for this low value, and they seek to change the standard as part of their next triennial review. However, recent regulatory developments appear to indicate the sulfate standard may be applied to more dischargers in the state. At this time, it is uncertain who those affected dischargers might be. The remainder of my testimony will address what this legislation seeks to do, and that is to eliminate this uncertainty by clearly establishing wild rice waters. This is of vital importance given the potential ramifications to the state. In 2011, the Minnesota legislature passed a law requiring that the Pollution Control Agency establish criteria for designating water subject to any wild rice water quality standard. This law required that the PCA consult with the DNR, Minnesota Indian Tribes, and other interested parties, such as the municipal and industrial wastewater dischargers, before designating any waters as wild rice waters. At this time, however, the full public notice and comment requirements of that law have not been fulfilled, and accordingly, no waters can legally be designated as wild rice waters. This legislation would seek to ensure that critical rulemaking process takes place. An example to illustrate this is the designation of trout waters in Minnesota. Not all waters in the state, as we know, are trout waters, because all waters don't contain trout or sufficient numbers of trout to classify them as such. The existing trout water designations we do have were made with the formal application of science, consultation with stakeholders, and the necessary public input. As a result, trout waters are clearly listed and defined in Minnesota rules. If one wants to know if a specific water body is a trout water, it is a straightforward matter to refer to the relevant rule and determine the status of that water. The process should be no different for the designation of wild rice waters. There is certainly much at stake with the designation of wild rice waters in Minnesota and the application of the sulfate standard. For the protection of the resource, wild rice, it's important to clearly identify, following solid scientific criteria and a formal public notice and input process, which waters are truly wild rice waters. This includes the time of the year that the rice is vulnerable. Secondly, if we get it wrong and waters are inappropriately or hastily designated, there could be highly impactful economic consequences and potentially no commensurate benefit to the resource that the underlying standard is seeking to protect. Those economic impacts can be severe. Unlike other more conventional wastewater treatment systems, sulfate removal to less than 10 parts per million requires a very intensive wastewater treatment system, typically reserved for applications like drinking water systems or boiler water makeup water. Those systems are typically quite small and have far lower flows than wastewater treatment facilities. There are few proven technologies that can meet this standard, and all are extremely expensive to install and maintain. The most likely treatment option would be a membrane system, which uses pressure to push water through a permeable membrane. Typically referred to as reverse osmosis, this treatment, while very expensive, can produce water that is less than 10 parts per million sulfate. However, only a percentage of the water coming in can actually be discharged. The remaining concentrate still needs to be disposed of. That concentrate needs additional treatment, and because it contains even higher levels of sulfate and metals and salts, the resulting treatment can cause the cost of a treatment system to increase significantly. For example, for a 2,000 gallon per minute discharge, costs could easily exceed $20 million in capital costs, with many million more, perhaps, in annual operating expenses. Not surprisingly, there are currently no reverse osmosis systems operating in Minnesota to treat municipal wastewater for discharge. There are other treatments available, and those include ion exchange, crystallization, and thermal evaporation, but these technologies are typically as or more expensive than membrane technology. Even relatively small dischargers could still be faced with many millions of dollars in investments. In summary, this bill simply confirms and reestablishes what the 2011 law pertaining to wild rice water quality standards already requires, and is wholly consistent with the historic approach to setting such standards in our state. The potential ramifications of the standard are enormous, and we do ensure that all stakeholders are represented in the setting of water quality standards and designations related to wild rice. Thank you for your interest in protecting our state's precious aquatic resources and for your time today. I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have. Thank you.
We'll save your questions for at the end. Next, we have two council members from Hoyt Lakes. If you could come down, Mr. Relan and Mr. Hedra. Yeah, and sorry about that. I was trying to do all three syllables fully. So if you guys could, I probably walked all over your range name. So welcome. If I'm not mistaken, you're from Hoyt Lakes. So
yes, thank you.
Just go ahead and pull up another chair. I've got 7 minutes between the two of you. So you know how you're going. Go ahead. Identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Chris Vreeland. I'm a Hoyt Lakes City Council member. I am a licensed state of Minnesota water and wastewater operator. I have been for 35 years. I contain a Class B wastewater license and a Class A water license. Thank you for allowing my input in this very important Minnesota.
Council member, do you mind me asking, are you employed outside of the city council and where is that at?
I was employed for the city of Aurora. I'm retired from the city of Aurora.
Thank you. Continue, councilman.
Thank you for allowing my input in this very important issue. Minnesota cities are committed to good wastewater treatment. I worked for the city of Aurora for 33 years in water and wastewater and public works. I know firsthand the costs associated with wastewater operations. In 2008, the city of Aurora started a wastewater plant upgrade to meet current standards at a cost of $7 million. The cost to households was a $20 per month increase. To meet the sulfate standards would be another $30 per month per household. I am currently a Hoyt Lake City Council member involved in our wastewater plant upgrade, again required to meet MPCA standards at a cost of $5 million. Our new permit just stated that now mercury standards will be in place in 5 years. The estimated cost in 5 years for that is $1.5 to $4 million just to meet mercury standards. And now a sulfate standard, $3 to $5 million more dollars. The sulfate standard alone would require the city of Hoyt Lakes $360,000 annually to maintain it. That's more than our current budget right now for wastewater operations just to run the sulfates. Where will the money come from? I guarantee you there'll be no grants out there. Every city in the state's gonna need this. There's no grant money available for that. Every dollar that we spend on wastewater treatment is a dollar not available for other infrastructure, public safety, and economic development. Again, we are committed to good wastewater treatment and clean water. We take that very seriously. We do expect that the standards that we are required to meet are backed by valid scientific evidence. I have been following the sulfate issue for several years, and the evidence to support a 10 part per million standard is not there. We strongly support Representative Moline's bill requiring the MPCA to designate water subject to wild rice standards in the ruling. We also want to be active participants in the process of designating those waters and the designation to be made part of the rule so we know where the standards apply. I live in northeastern Minnesota. I'm at a cabin by Representative Dills on Crane Lake. The wild rice on that lake depends on the water level every year. The year the level is fairly low, there's lots of wild rice. The year the water, we get a lot of rain, there's not as much. Wild rice is more affected by weather than anything else. Thank you for time and consideration in this matter. We hope you will take our concerns into account. Thank you, Mr.
Chair. Thank you, Councilman. Welcome, Councilman. If you could identify yourself for the record and give us your testimony.
My name is Brad Hadrava. I'm the Eveleth City Councilman. I work for the Eveleth Gilbert Schools. I have a chief boilers license, and as we just heard, it is expensive to take care of the boiler water as well as our sewer treatment water. With that being said, I have a couple short statements, Mr. Chair. Eveleth is a growing city. About 100 years ago, we had 7,400 people. Due to industry changes and the economies, we shrank to 5,000 people. We maintained that for quite a while. Through the 70s and the 80s and the economic downturn in the mining industry, we shrank to 3,500. This isn't uncommon in all the cities in northeastern Minnesota that depend on mining. If we did an economic impact study, we find that this is not just a northeastern Minnesota problem. This is going to be a problem throughout the state of Minnesota. Every town, every school district that has a boiler system, everybody is going to be impacted by this bill. We strongly recommend that you support Ms. Moline's bill, House Bill 1000. With that being said, I have another quick letter here. from the mayor of Gilbert, Minnesota. He could not be here.
Continue, Councilman. If you could paraphrase the letter, that'd be great. Do you have just the one copy of it?
I do, and okay. You may have it.
No, no, you go ahead. It looks real short. You can read it.
It is very short, sir. No.
You're under your time. You're doing good. Thank you.
It just says...
Typical Ranger, get to the point and get her done.
Thanks. I am writing this letter to show unified support to PolyMet and all active mining. Currently, the city of Gilbert and our community could not function without mining, and it is our bread and butter in the workforce and paying good-paying jobs. The spin-off jobs in the mining industry is also to be considered. The Iron Range could not survive without these high-paying jobs, and Gilbert supports mining. Rob Fucci, City of Gilbert Mayor.
Thank you, Councilman. Next, we have Mr. Sutherland from U.S. Steel and Mr. Bartovich from U.S. Steel also. Did I
walk Ms. Bartovich, in? Mr. Chair.
Ms., sorry. I got to put my... Representative Moline, I should be putting my glasses on instead of trying to read this real small print or get Ms. Zipko to print it substantially larger. Welcome. If you could identify yourself for the record... It looks like we've got 10 minutes, five for the male and five for the female. So go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and assembled committeemen. I'd like to also thank our members of United Steelworkers who have agreed to participate in this important dialogue today with our industry. My name is Larry Sutherland. I'm the head of United States Steel Mining Solutions, which encompasses all of our iron ore operations in the United States. With almost 40 years in the iron and steel industry and having been raised on the Iron Range in northeastern Minnesota, I understand not only how important environmental stewardship is to our citizens on the Iron Range who live and work there, but also to the citizens of the state of Minnesota. That being said, I'd like to provide a little background of who we are and what we do, Chairman.
United Go States, ahead, Mr. Sutherland.
Thank you, Chairman. United States Steel Corporation, headquartered in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is an integrated steel producer with major production operations in the United States and Central Europe and an annual raw steel making capability of 24.4 million net tons of steel. The company manufactures a wide range of value-added steel sheet and tubular products for the automotive, appliance, container, industrial machinery, construction, and oil and gas industries. United States Steel's Minnesota ore operations, consisting of MinTac and KeyTac in northeastern Minnesota, is the state's largest iron ore producer. Iron ore is the key ingredient in blast furnace-based steel production. United States Steel's Minnesota ore operation directly employs 1,900 people. These are high-quality, well-paying jobs. Our iron ore operations also create thousands of other jobs that help our communities and other companies. Every U.S. steel mining job in Minnesota creates an additional 1.8 jobs in other sectors of the economy. Our annual payroll is over $150 million, annual health care benefits of over $36 million, annual pension benefits of over $30 million, plus more than $6.4 million to the Steelworkers Pension Trust Fund. Our active United Steelworker retirees, once employed by Minnesota ore operations, equates to 1,594.
Mr. Sutherland, do you know how much you pay annually to the school trust? Maybe you could touch on that if you would.
Yes, sir. $55 million per year in the school trust land royalty payments, which is 94% of the total contributions to this fund for public education in Minnesota.
And why would U.S. Steel pay any money into the school trust fund?
Because of the lands we mine, the royalties we pay, etc., goes to the school land.
Just to clarify, Mr. Sutherland, you're mining on land that is owned by the state of Minnesota and held in trust for the school kids, and you've negotiated with the DNR to make payments for that ore. And that, if I'm not mistaken, when we were up there, I believe it was the year before last, one single blast was $1 million into the school trust land that I think got deposited within the next 12 months. So I just think in perspective, a lot of people don't realize what that's about, so I wanted to make that. And you are right that you are. Is it a Keewatin plant where most of that is?
No, that's a MinPAC facility, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you for correcting me. Continue on.
Our annual local taxes include 2013 taconite production taxes of $43.8 million, as well as the school trust that we just discussed. Beneficiaries of taconite production tax revenues are Range School Districts and the Iron Range Resources and Rehabilitation Board, which helps create new jobs, promote business growth, and improve Iron Range communities. We do business with over 370 suppliers and vendors in the state of Minnesota with an annual spend of $612 million. U.S. Steel takes our responsibility to protect and preserve our environment very seriously. Environmental protection is a core principle of United States Steel. I would now like to ask Chrissy Bartovich to offer a brief overview of our environmental activities.
Welcome, Ms. Bartovich. Good to see you again, and apologize for not reading better. Thank you.
That's okay, Mr.
Go ahead. If you could identify yourself for the record.
You got the name right, which is typically the more difficult to do.
Well, Representative Rukavina would have been disappointed if I didn't get halfway close. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Chrissy Bartovich. I hold a master's degree in environmental health and safety. That better? And I have 15 years of experience with U.S. Steel. I am the Director of Environmental for the Minnesota Ore Operations, which, as Mr. Sutherland mentioned, is the MinTAC and KeyTAC facilities.
Ms. Bartovich, can you give us some historical perspective of where you came from, where you went to school, and how you ended up where you did?
Absolutely. I'm a lifelong resident of northeastern Minnesota. I'm a third-generation miner, so my grandfather was a Butler Taconite employee, but my father still works at United Taconite now. I grew up in Virginia, Minnesota, went to high school there, and then went to University of Minnesota Duluth, where I got my undergraduate and then got my master's degree, actually after I started at U.S. Steel, and they allowed me to work part-time, get my degree, and paid for it. So kind of fell into environmental, tried it as an internship opportunity at U.S. Steel, and loved it, and have been there ever since. So only place I've ever worked.
Well, we like to get the real touch of people and understand what brings them where they are and who they are. So thank you for that perspective. Continue on.
Yeah, so I'm here today to talk about the environmental commitment and the track record that U.S. Steel has in Minnesota. And I'm going to just touch on a couple of projects. In 2010, MinTAC installed what we call a seep collection return system on the east side of our tailings basin. So that project collects surface and shallow subsurface water that was coming out of the basin and pumps it back in. That project has shown drastic improvements in water quality downstream from the basin. In 2010 and 2011, MinTAC installed low NOx main burners on two of our five operating lines at MinTAC, which has drastically reduced air emissions. We are also moving forward with additional installations. In 2014, a project was constructed that started up in January of 2015, which routes better quality makeup water from the west end of our pit into the process, which reduces the mass loading of constituents brought into our system. And I highlight these projects for several reasons. These were all innovative projects. These were not installed anywhere throughout the country, throughout the world, in taconite. So these were things that U.S. Steel commissioned and worked on and championed, and they resulted in considerable environmental improvements. So I tell you this because although business conditions are not ideal, we are willing to spend money when there's a clear understanding of what the requirements are and the science behind those requirements is sound. This is not the case with the Wildrice sulfate standard. The process has not been followed to establish criteria and designate the waters for which the use exists. Until the process is followed, which we believe was clearly established in both the Clean Water Act and the 2011 legislation, the standard should not be applied.
Thank you. Are you both finished? I know I ran over with a couple of points I wanted to make.
Chairman,
Mr. Sutherland, shortly. Go ahead.
Thank you, Chairman. 2015 is likely to be a critical year for the future of mining in Minnesota. There are currently several issues with significant implications for the iron mining industry and the jobs it provides. Chief among those issues will be the application of the wild rice sulfate water quality standard. U.S. Steel believes the MPCA should adhere to the 2011 legislation and the Clean Water Act by designating waters through rulemaking prior to applying the standard. In addition to the procedural component, the research conducted by both the MPCA's research and that of the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce needs to be considered to ensure sound science is used in future rulemaking. We are particularly concerned that KeyTac has the only NEPDES permit with the 10 milligram per liter standard applied and potentially will have the second permit when the draft MNTAC tailings basin NEPDES permit is placed on public notice. Designation of waters would be conducted through a formal rulemaking process, which will allow for public participation and provide another opportunity to vet the sulfate wild rice science. In short, the legislature has taken the opportunity to ensure that the MPCA adheres to the procedures for promulgating a water quality standard outlined in the Clean Water Act by requiring that the agency designate wild rice waters prior to enforcing a sulfate water quality standard.
Thank you, Mr. Sutherland and Ms. Bartovich. Next, we will have Mr. Baranek. If you could come down, I believe you might be with Cliff. Looks like I've got 7 minutes for you. If you could identify yourself for the record and begin your testimony, we would appreciate that.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. It's Rob Baranek. It's not a range name, it's a Uper name, so.
Okay.
All right. I'm the manager of water regulatory and strategy and planning for Cliff's Natural Resources, and I appreciate the time you're giving me today to testify.
And, sir, who is Cliff?
Cliff's Natural Resources?
Yes.
We operate United Taconite, Hibbing Taconite, and North Shore Mining Company on the range of Minnesota.
Thank you. I wanted folks to know that. Thank you. Continue.
Together, those facilities that we operate in Minnesota can produce up to 19.5 million tons of pellets annually and employ over 1,800 people on the range, with a total economic impact of over $900 million to the range. In my role with Cliffs, I'm responsible for regulatory planning, permitting, and compliance related to the regulation of water at Cliffs U.S. iron ore mining and processing facilities. For the last several years, I've been personally involved in working with the MPCA, other regulated entities, water quality experts, and legal advisors to understand the science behind and the regulatory underpinnings of the Minnesota Sulfate Wild Rice Standard. So thanks again for the opportunity today to testify. This legislation, introduced by Representatives Moline, Lewick, Metza, Enzels, and Dill, is critical to ensuring that the MPCA meets its obligations under the Clean Water Act and Minnesota's 2011 Wild Rice Law to conduct a rulemaking process to establish wild rice waters subject to Minnesota's sulfate standard. In my testimony today, I will detail why House File 1000 prescribes the proper method for promulgating a water quality standard. Second, I will address the current state of research on sulfate and wild rice and share our perspective on why it's necessary to take a thoughtful, transparent approach to the designation of waters subject to the standard. And lastly, I will characterize the potential impact of the sulfate wild rice standard on Cliffs, Minnesota operations. The purpose of water quality standards are to define water quality goals of a water body or portions of it by designating the use or uses and by setting criteria necessary to protect those uses. The Clean Water Act prescribes an approach to developing water quality standards that are like the three legs of a stool. And without all three legs, the stool cannot stand. In order to properly implement an enforceable standard, an agency must first identify the use which is meant to be protected. In the case of wild rice production, the MPCA established this use in 1973, but that term, wild rice production, was never well defined. The agency has not prescribed the types of water bodies in which wild rice grows, nor the quantities in which it must grow to be regulated in order for it to be designated for the use. The second leg of this stool requires the agency to develop specific numeric criteria using sound scientific rationale to protect the use. For example, as you heard from Minnesota Power earlier, the temperature of cold water fisheries must be maintained to protect trout. In the case of wild rice, the PCA has proposed a numeric sulfate criteria. However, this current criteria of 10 milligrams per liter has not been developed using sufficient scientific data and analysis and is not supported by the contemporary research that has been conducted to date. Thirdly, the agency must designate the specific waters or portions thereof in which the use is to be protected by the numerical standard. The benefits of this approach are that it provides advance notice to regulated entities which will be subject to the standard, and it provides a transparent process through which the public can participate and comment in the development of the standards. The PCA has yet to designate the specific waters that are to be protected for the production of wild rice, and thus this stool with two flimsy legs cannot stand. Today, having failed to conduct rulemaking, the PCA is left to determine which waters are subject to the standard on a case-by-case basis, creating great uncertainty for the permitted entities in the state of Minnesota. What is more perplexing to me is that this is the only instance in which the PCA has proceeded in this manner. For all other water quality standards, the waters are either identified or identifiable by rule. I would also like to address the numeric criterion that is being contemplated to protect wild rice. CLIF complies with many standards that have been appropriately developed and protect the environment. However, we think that investments made to treat for sulfate should result in actual environmental benefits. On this issue, the science is not yet in as to if and how the sulfate treatment would benefit wild rice. Over the past years, studies have been conducted through public and private funding to examine the relationship between sulfate and wild rice. The result of these studies provide similar conclusions. One, sulfate in and of itself is not harmful to rice. Two, sulfate has the potential to indirectly impact wild rice growth through the transformation into sulfide, and at the same time, iron may mitigate this potential for even occurring. Importantly, these results have shifted the discussion from sulfate to sulfide and underscore the need for research on the relationship between these constituents, which has not yet been conducted. Moreover, the PCA has failed to contemplate how numerous other factors may confound and complicate observations of wild rice growth in Minnesota. Factors which have been cited to impact wild rice include hydrological influences such as fluctuating lake levels, shoreland development and changes in land use, competitive native plants and non-native invasives, elevated nutrient levels, genetic engineering, and climate change. In short, setting a standard with extensive economic and operational impacts must be thoroughly researched and should have a high level of certainty in producing environmental benefits. Criteria that have not been met for this sulfate limit to date. Taconite mining and processing is inherently a water intensive, and as a result, this industry is particularly sensitive to the regulatory requirements of a wild rice sulfate standard. While technologies for treating sulfate exist, they require tens of millions of dollars in upfront costs, as well as millions per year to operate them on an ongoing basis. Adding these costs on a year-by-year basis to remove sulfate could fundamentally shift the cost structure of our operations. Subjecting permitted entities to a standard that could alter their economics without scientific consensus on a numeric standard and without meeting all the requirements of the Clean Water Act is adverse to the interests of everyone in the state of Minnesota. In closing, I urge you to keep in mind that this legislation does not prejudge the outcome of the PCA sulfate wild rice scientific analysis. Rather, it ensures that the sulfate wild rice standard is administered in a manner that is transparent, inclusive, and compliant with both state and federal law. Furthermore, by clarifying the 2011 sulfate law, this bill will limit the adverse economic consequences that could arise if PCA proceeds in enforcing this standard on a case-by-case basis before waters are designated and the standard is modified to reflect new science. Thank you again, Mr. Chairman, for the opportunity to testify today, and I thank again the sponsors for House File 1000 and the committee here today.
Thank you, Mr. Baronic. We appreciate it. Next, we'll hear from Ms. McElby from Water Legacy. If you could come down, thank you. Ms. McElby, I have you down for 10 minutes. Welcome. Good to see you again. And if you could identify yourself for the record and who you represent. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Paula McElby, and I live at 1961 Selby Avenue in St. Paul. I serve as the Advocacy Director and Counsel for Water Legacy, which is a nonprofit group formed to protect Minnesota's water resources and the communities that rely on them. Our 10,000 members include people who hunt, fish, and gather wild rice, as well as teachers, chemists, and biologists. They have identified wild rice as an indicator species for Arrowhead regional ecosystems and have made the preservation of natural wild rice a high priority. So as a result, Water Legacy has been active in evaluating and preserving the wild rice sulfate standard since at least 2009. We've reviewed thousands of pages of federal and state documents dating back to 1973 when Minnesota's wild rice sulfate standard was adopted. We were involved in the 2011 session when this legislature appropriated over $1 million to study the impacts of sulfate on wild rice. We've served actively on the advisory committee that was created by this legislature, and we've participated in every step of the scientific peer review process, going to every meeting and presenting information and watching the scientists at their work. In addition, when the Chamber of Commerce sued the state in 2011 to prevent enforcement of the wild rice sulfate standard, arguing many of the things they're arguing today, Water Legacy intervened in the court case. The Chamber of Commerce claims were defeated and dismissed both in Minnesota District Court and at the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Water Legacy is here today to speak against the adoption of House File 1000 on two separate grounds. First, the scientific evidence gathered as a result of taxpayer-funded research demonstrates clearly that interference with enforcement of the existing Minnesota wild rice sulfate standard would be unreasonable and unscientific. Second, legislation that would prevent the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, or MPCA, from fulfilling its obligations to control sulfate pollution and list wild rice impaired waters would conflict with the Clean Water Act, which is governing federal law. As the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, advised in 2011, failure of our state of Minnesota to comply with the Clean Water Act and enforce the wild rice sulfate standard could result in Minnesota's loss of state authority to control state water pollution. First, Minnesota's existing wild rice sulfate standard is reasonable and it should be enforced. Since 2011, the MPCA hired the best scientists from the University of Minnesota and engaged in the most comprehensive study of wild rice sulfate anywhere in the world. As a result of this research, the MPCA concluded in February 2014, sulfate is not directly toxic to wild rice. However, sulfate in the surface water can be converted by bacteria to sulfide in the rooting zone of wild rice. Next, sulfide is toxic to wild rice. And the MPCA continued, and this document was never released to the public, but we got it. It's an official document under the Data Practices Act. People are in the public are entitled to get these documents. The MPCA continued, the 10 milligrams per liter sulfate standard is needed and reasonable to protect wild rice production from sulfate-driven sulfite toxicity. And finally, the 10 milligram per liter wild rice sulfate standard should continue to apply to both lakes and streams. Then the Pollution Control Agency, to add another level of scientific protection from any pressure to deregulate pollution, had a panel of 7 international scientists review the wild rice sulfate research in detail. And these scientists issued their final report just in September of 2014, not that long ago. Although the scientists asked for more statistics to tease out the sulfate interactions in the environment with phosphorus and iron, they told the PCA also that sulfide might be even more toxic than the agency had thought. And finally, the peer review panel found that Minnesota's research and regulation limiting sulfate to protect wild rice was scientifically valid. And the panel explained that just as one might, our laws limit mercury, even though the toxic chemical is methylmercury, that it is legitimate to regulate sulfate. And this is a quote from their report, sulfide is harmful, but sulfate is what has to be regulated.
Ms. McElby, excuse me, I forgot to note, members, you have the handout that Ms. McElby is following on. She's now at the top of page 3. Continue.
Thank you, sir. Second, the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency is obligated under federal law to enforce the existing wild rice sulfate standard and to list wild rice waters that are impaired by sulfate pollution. And you will find, Mr. Chair and committee members, in your handouts, documents and excerpts of documents that have to do with some of these legal issues. I'm going to summarize them briefly. First, as committee members might remember from 2011, the EPA has already explained to Minnesota that state law may not interfere with enforcement of federally approved water quality-based effluent limitations and permits, including the wild rice sulfate standard. The wild rice sulfate standard was adopted in 1973 under the authority of the Clean Water Act. It was reviewed and it was approved. So if you can recall, and I have a copy in there of the EPA's May 13, 2011 letter, and I'm just reading it without all the citations. A state with a federally authorized NPDES program is required to issue permits that ensure the protection of federally approved water quality standards. Where a state proposes to issue a permit that fails to apply or ensure compliance with any applicable requirement, including water quality-based effluent requirements, EPA has the authority to review and to object to such permit issuance pursuant to its authority. So if the state were to have permits that did not enforce the wild rice sulfate standard, the federal government has the power basically to take over the permitting function. And the question that is really before us in this bill, whether the wild rice sulfate standard must be enforced in wild rice waters that are not listed by name, has been addressed both by the EPA and by Minnesota District Court. In your packets, you can see from the environmental review documents for the Keetac and the Polymet project that the EPA concluded enforcement of the 10 milligrams per liter wild rice sulfate standard was mandatory. It's not discretionary. And the EPA also said that the standard must be enforced in waters such as Swan Lake, Swan River, Hay Creek, Hay Lake, and the Partridge River, where site-specific data showed that wild rice was present. Judge Marinan in the District Court in Minnesota concluded in dismissing the Chamber of Commerce lawsuit, and these are her words, neither the Constitution nor Minnesota or federal statutes require a state to list expressly every surface water to which a water quality standard applies. Such a requirement would be particularly absurd in a state such as Minnesota. And in another conclusion of law, on the contrary, the Federal Clean Water Act allows for application of water quality standards to water bodies that are implicated without being expressly listed on an individual basis. And just as enforcing water quality standards, including the wild rice sulfate standard, is mandatory, not discretionary, states are also required, and this is under Section 303D of the Clean Water Act, to list impaired waters. The Clean Water Act requires all states to submit to EPA every 2 years a list of impaired waters and then to set priorities for plans to clean up those waters. And that's that TMDL thing that you've probably discussed in other hearings. Minnesota has an obligation, which has been affirmed by EPA, to release a list of wild rice impaired waters, and the deadline for that release was actually 2014. So provisions of House File 1000 stating that the Pollution Control Agency should not apply the wild rice water quality standard or list wild rice impaired waters until the Pollution Control Agency adopts rule changes, that is inconsistent with federal Clean Water Act requirements. And state failure to comply with the Federal Clean Water Act matters. In 2011, the EPA included in its letter to this legislature on May 13th the following advice. Should EPA determine that a state is not administering its federally approved NPDES program in accordance with the requirements of the Clean Water Act, EPA has the authority to require the state to take corrective action and, if necessary, to withdraw authorization of the program. Now, federal regulations copied on the last page of our committee handout provide that the EPA may withdraw state authority to regulate water quality when a state program no longer complies with federal clean water law. Among the circumstances that demonstrate noncompliance are failure to issue permits, issuing permits that don't protect beneficial uses, failure to act on permit violations, and this one is a quote, action by a state legislature or court striking down or limiting state authorities. Water Legacy agrees with many of the people who've testified today that it would be better for all of us if MPCA could proceed more quickly to release its proposals regarding the wild rice rule. However, we believe that the proposed HF 1000 legislation is part of the problem, not part of the solution. Every time political pressure is proposed to serve the interests of the mining industry and other industrial dischargers, we believe Minnesota slips farther away from science and farther away from the Clean Water Act requirements to control sulfate and other pollution in order to protect wild rice and also to protect mammals, wildlife, and other uses of clean water. At some point, we are afraid Minnesota's legitimacy in serving as a regulator of water pollution discharged by the mining industry will reach the point where our state's authority can no longer be defended or sustained. I'd be pleased to answer any questions by the committee.
Thank you, Ms. McElvey. We'll continue on with the rest of the testimony and save the questions for later. And thank you for keeping close to your time limit. I appreciate that. Next, we have Mr. Reuter from the legal director for MCEA. If you could come down. There you are. Thank you. If you could identify yourself for the record, Mr. Reuter, it looks like you're somewhere around 7 minutes, or what's your anticipation?
Oh, I think that will be fine.
Thank
Mr.
you.
Chairman.
Go ahead. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Kevin Reuter. I'm the legal director for the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy, MCEA. MCEA is an environmental nonprofit using law, science, and research to protect Minnesota's natural resources, wildlife, and the health of its people. We work on policies here at the state legislature. We work with the state agencies implementing the laws that are passed, and we also, when necessary, work in the courts. Among the environmental advocacy groups, MCEA is often thought of as the lawyers, and so my intention was to focus mainly on legal arguments and sort of the law. Ms. McAvey has stole my thunder a little bit in providing you with a great outline of the issue that I wanted to address, which is why this bill, House File 1000, conflicts with federal law. But I think it's an important enough issue that I do want to step back and not totally reiterate what she said, but explain once again the analysis that goes into that. Many of the federal environmental laws contemplate a shared responsibility between the federal government and the states. And that's the case here with the Clean Water Act. When Congress passed the bill, it intended that there could be a role for the states. And that's the case in Minnesota. Minnesota developed a program, went to the EPA and requested to become what's referred to as a delegated state. And so the state gets to implement the Clean Water Act's permitting program here on behalf of the federal government. But there are certain restrictions that come along with that. For one, the state program has to meet the requirements of the federal act. And EPA maintains oversight of what the states do in implementing the act. In practice, that means that when a state does not comply with the act, EPA can take certain steps. And you heard some of those from Ms. McAvey. EPA retains the authority to object to any permit that the state might try to issue, for example. It can object to any enforcement action or a lack of enforcement action that the state is pursuing. It can call for the state to implement what's referred to as corrective actions. So there may be a problem with the program and the way that it's being implemented, and the state is told by EPA to correct a certain piece of the program. And then it can also withdraw the authority and actually become the permitting authority for the state. So in that case, if the EPA were to withdraw authority from Minnesota, for example, folks who have permits here or new projects would need to go to Chicago, where the EPA Region 5 office is. We're in Region 5 to get their permits. The problem with this bill is that it takes an existing water quality standard, an element that is a requirement of the Clean Water Act, and one that has been approved by EPA, and it makes it unusable and unenforceable. The bill says essentially that the standard can't be implemented in permits. As Representative Moline said, I think that it suspends the implementation of the standard. And the Clean Water Act, on the other hand, requires that the state use existing and approved water quality standards in permitting. And it requires the state to identify those waters that aren't meeting the standard and list them, as you heard, on the 303D list of impaired waters. That's the list of waters that we need to work on cleaning up. Also, as Ms. McAbee pointed out, the EPA Region 5 has already told the state that the intent of this type of legislation will violate the Clean Water Act. And I guess we don't see a difference between this bill and the bill that EPA reviewed back in 2011 when they put together that letter for you. I do have one example that I wanted to share of a state legislature acting in an analogous way, I think, that is instructive for us here, and that's Arkansas. Back in 2013, the Arkansas legislature passed a bill that changed the existing approved by EPA water quality standard for Arkansas. It did a couple of things. It changed the way that stream flow was calculated, and that it also changed a presumption that all of the waters in Arkansas were potential drinking waters. It sort of flipped that on the head, on its head. And so the effect was to allow for more pollution. And so the state agency, after that law was passed in 2013, spent many months mending its rules and starting to look at permits differently. And in August of that year, the state received a letter from EPA Region 6, which is where Arkansas is, saying that EPA would now be reviewing each and every of the minor NPDES permits that the state issued. And so what happened in Arkansas is that every one of those permits had to go to EPA. It really mucked up the process. And by October of 2013, in a special session, the Arkansas legislature decided to repeal that law.
Mr. Ruther, if you could wrap it up in the next minute, that'd be great. Thank you.
Actually, that's all that I have, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Appreciate you coming forward and staying within the time. Next, I'd like to hear from on our list is Winona LaDuc. If you could come forward and give us your testimony. Ms. LaDuc, I have down 5 minutes. Does that sound right? Thank you. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself and who you represent for the record. Good to see you.
Thank you, Anine Indaway Maganaduk, Nigagagitamagas, Vine Sikwe Edigo Makwanodium. My name is Winona LaDuc. I'm an Anishinaabe from the White Earth Band, Mississippi Band. I'm a traditional wild rice harvester. I have been for my whole adult life. I come from a community that harvests a lot of wild rice. For many years, I directed an organization called Native Harvest, which is one of the single largest wild rice marketing agencies in Indian country. And as far as my academic credentials, I'm a rural development economist. I graduated from Harvard University. I went to the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and I've testified largely on issues of economics in a wide variety of arenas.
Ms. LaDuc, do you mind me asking, we're glad you're here, and thank you for testifying, and where your educational credentials have always impressed me, and thank you for doing a great job.
That's a lot of work, a lot of homework.
Well, it's way beyond mine. So, but where did you grow up? Where did you come from?
I was raised in Southern Oregon, a small town of about 10,000. I am enrolled from White Earth. I moved back when I got out of college in 1981, last century.
Thank you.
Is that good?
Yeah, no, that's good. Thank you. I just like to get the perspective. Thank you.
Okay.
Continue.
So I have several points I'm going to make, and I just want to, again, thank the previous people who testified. I want to first talk a little bit about historical amnesia. That is to say that wild rice is protected under treaties. It is explicitly protected under the treaties that were made between my people and your people. And in particular, in the 1837, the 55, and the 54 treaty, we believe that treaties should be upheld by nations. And we would like to keep our part of the treaty, and we would like to keep you to keep your part of the treaty. As far as something called ecological amnesia, it is an interesting moment, because often I drive through the North Country, Anishinaabeg King, that's what we call the North Country, the territory that our people know. And I find that when I drive by places, my elders or my sister or my family will say, there was a rice bed there. We used to rice there. We used to rice here. We used to rice over there. There are a multitude of rice beds in northern Minnesota that are no longer designated as rice beds. And there are places that our people have harvested for thousands of years. So I'm really interested in your process of quantification, because I feel like quantification lacks any historical perspective. And in fact, we have become people who have ecological amnesia. We no longer remember the plentitude of rice that existed within our territories, except for Anishinaabe people remember that. And so I want to say, I think about this, I say, so if you destroy the rice bed, does it no longer exist? It is no longer a rice water. If you say the same thing about trout and there's only four trout left in the river because the Kalamazoo spill, is it no longer a trout river? How is it that that is determined? And I think that we really need to think about that, because if we want to be the people who hang out here for another 1,000 years, we might as well figure out how to keep an ecology that has some life in it. I want to say that in terms of the implications of wild rice for Anishinaabe people, I think that you all maybe know that. I'm well aware that it's the state grain, that's a good thing. But for us, it is our most sacred food. It is the first food eaten, and is usually the last food eaten. It is something that is served at all our ceremonies and feasts. It is something that is sacred. It is something that, as Anishinaabe people, is a part of our migration story and is an essential food to us as people. So we do not view lightly any suggestion of limiting the ability of rice to sustain itself within the lakes of our territory. And I think that actually a lot of Minnesotans would agree. It's a funny thing, because I have very low blood pressure, but every time I come here, the last time I came here was on wild rice, I'm sure that my blood pressure must rise significantly. What I will say is that for our people, it is not only a spiritual food, but I live in a community that about a third of the people have diabetes. We have the highest rates of many food problems, you know, because we are poor. And our food that the Creator gave us is wild rice. Our food that the Creator gave us is fish. Our food that the Creator gave us is deer. Those are things that may be viewed as resources by others, but that is what the Creator gave us to live on. And so I want to say that, because that food is essential to our health. And while we are talking specifically about wild rice standards and sulfate, the fact is that if sulfate and sulfide increases the methyl mercury that occurs in fish and within our ecosystem, that is something that is a problem. I live on a lake, and I am a subsistence harvester. I have raised 6 children, and I have about 8 grandchildren, and we eat fish. And I am told, my kids ask me, how many fish can we eat this week? That is what people ask. And that is something that people ask all across the North. And we need to be the people that ensure that everything is protected so that we can eat them, and that our children can eat them, and that our grandchildren can eat them, and those that come after that. The last part of my kind of more academic remarks is as an economist. It is really an absurd equation. You know, with great reverence, I come from a family that also has union people in it. And I just want to say this, is that you cannot say that the Iron Range will not survive. The Iron Range pre-existed all of us. You know, it is a territory that pre-existed all of us. But what I will say is that we have entered an era of extreme extraction. That means to get a ton of copper, you have to get 1 million pounds of waste. That means that the economics and the mining industry and the oil industry says that we cannot afford to clean things up because it is too expensive. And so they do not have to count what is known as the diseconomies of their practices in terms of their bottom line. And that is false economics. It is taught in universities and is repeated in these. It's the wrong way to teach economics, because if you cannot drink your water, you will not survive. If you cannot eat your fish and you have no rice, it will not survive. Just in conclusion, I'm not here representing the tribal governments. But the fact is that it is, you know, I would like to live in a state where Native people are respected. I would like to live in a state where Native people do not have to come down to the legislature every time someone has something that will be so destructive to us and our peoples. I would like to live in a state where I felt like policymakers respect Native people, and that we do not have to make such sojourns for such frivolous and ridiculous proposals. And that is what I really feel like, you know. So I want to thank you for your time, and I want to ask you in your rulemaking process to take care of these things, because they are worth everything to not only our people, but really all of us. So thank you.
Ms. LaDuke, I want to thank you for coming down, and we need your perspective as we deal with this. As you noted, this is a really tough issue. As for someone who grew up extremely close to the Native Americans in the Prairie Island community as a young kid, some of what we did in the past wasn't right, and I look forward to the challenges. You bring a terrific perspective that all of us need to see. But this is a serious issue that needs to be dealt with. The implications for our state are serious, and we need you to be a voice of reason and common sense to help us understand your perspective. But at the same time, we need to move forward. We can't have people just kick the can or get cold feet and not do. This is a tough issue, but the implications for wastewater treatment plants and Fairmont, Minnesota, are significant and serious. We need to find something that works. So I ask you to please stay engaged, stay close. Believe it or not, we all have grandchildren, many of us do, and we are extremely concerned for them, for the future. So thank you for your time to come down here. I would encourage you to always come down and speak your piece and not look at it as an unfortunate situation, because I think it's good for folks to hear what you have to say. You have an extreme amount of credibility, and you're well respected, and it's important that we hear from you. And I say those words with some folks may not agree with me, but we need to hear all perspectives. And so thank you for coming forward. Next, we have Mr. Thayer, and he's the last testifier short of MPCA. If there's any other public testifiers, if you could go over to the pages, I will give anyone in the public 1 minute to testify. So if anybody wants to testify, if you could go over to the pages and give them your name so we can have that. You will be given 1 minute to testify if you want to say something. Mr. Thayer, if you could identify yourself for the record and who you represent.
Yeah, my name is...
I see you're limited to 5 minutes, or that's what you've told us it'll take.
Okay, my name is Charlie Thayer, and I'm here today speaking on behalf of myself and my family.
Go ahead, Mr. Thayer.
I'm Anishinaabe from the Lake Superior Band, who grew up harvesting what we call Manoman. I've been harvesting since I was about 6 years old. I'm now 30, so I've been harvesting for about a total of 24 years. My people have been harvesting for much longer than that, and we've been the caretakers of the land long before any entity began mining here in the state of Minnesota. It is important that it is recognized today that many indigenous communities continue to eat fish and wild rice harvested from the many waterways here in Minnesota, waterways that would be affected by a limited discharge of sulfate. On my way here this morning, I thought about the importance of wild rice to my people. Wild rice is much more than a food for us. It is a medicine and a way of life. As a child, I remember growing up sitting around a fire as we would harvest rice that we collected that day. This was a time of learning for us. To this day, I live by important lessons that I learned during the time of harvest, lessons of respect, integrity, honesty, and most of all, to be forever be a warrior for the land and the water. I hope that future generations can continue to do this without the fear of sickness and poisoning. And that's all I have. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Mr. Thayer. I think I see about 3 total members of the public. Is there anyone else, if you could raise your hand? I think the pages have 3. Mr. Tammen and Mr. Tammen, I believe somebody's in front of you, though. The woman behind you, is she not want to testify? I thought she signed up first. Ma'am, if you could come forward. Mr. Tammen, you're going to be second. You're going to be second. Sorry. Ladies first. If you could come forward. Miss, if you could identify yourself for the record and who you represent, that'd be great. Thank you.
My name is Sharon Day, and I don't know if I represent them, but I'm the executive director of the Indigenous Peoples Task Force, located in Minneapolis. I grew up. I'm a Boys Fort enrollee, and I grew up on the Iron Range, and I grew up harvesting wild rice, and I still harvest wild rice today at Net Lake, which is just. Just a little bit north of the Iron Range, and I also do something called we walk many of the rivers, and so to raise awareness. But we believe that everything has a spirit, that the water has a spirit. And so we walk the Mississippi River, and this fall we walk the St. Louis River. And when we walk those rivers, we speak to the spirit in the rivers. And there was a young girl asked me once, well, the mining companies, they're so powerful. You know, what can we do? And what I said to her is, no matter how much money the mining companies have, the water is so much more powerful. But when we put these chemicals in the water, you know, that's what we're destroying, is we're attacking the spirit of that water. And that's in the water is the life force of everything. And I don't care what race you are, without water, we will not survive. And, you know, the fact of the matter is all the water we have is all the water we're ever going to have. There used to be rice in the St. Louis River, and there is no more. So thank you very much.
Thank you. And could you, if you don't mind, give us your name for the record again, because we might not have got it. Thank you.
My name is Sharon Day. That's my English name. But my Ojibwe name is Nagumo Mayingin.
Can you say that slower and repeat it again for all of us?
My
English part I got now.
Okay. Nagumo Mayingin, which is Singing Wolf. And I'm from the Martin clan, Wabasheshi and Dotem. And I'm second degree Madewan, which is a spiritual pathway of our people.
Thank you for coming down. Yeah. Mr. Tamman, if you could go next. And I believe there's one more after you, and then we're going to hear from MPCA.
Thank you, Mr.
Chair. 1 minute, Mr. Tamman.
Bob Tamman from Sudan, Minnesota. I heard several comments about this wild rice standard not being enforced since implementation in 1973. And I think, as someone who worked in the mines, lives on the range, it's likely that it was not enforced because industry did not want it to be enforced. And I say this having worked at MinTac, that tailings pond's been leaking ever since I started working there. Their permit expired in 92. They're still running on an expired permit. We hear all the complaints. We need to streamline the permitting process, get it done quicker. They don't want that permitting process streamlined. They want to run on that old permit that lets them dump degraded water into our public waters. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Tamman. And was there one more gentleman to speak? No, that's it. MPCA, if you could come down, Assistant Commissioner Flood and Director Lothammer, if you could come down. I'm sorry, Ms. Representative Moline.
Can I just make a few comments before we get to the MPCA? I'll run out of time if I don't do it now.
No, I think if you want to give some comments now, and then you're also going to get time at the end to wrap up. Does MPCA, can you show me your fingers how long your testimony is? If you have more than that, five, or is that five each? Ten total?
It depends on questions, Mr. Chair.
Okay, without questions, five minutes. Thank you. Representative Moline.
I'll wait then, Mr. Chair.
Okay. If you would come down, Assistant Commissioner and Director, identify yourself for the record. We'll take about 5 minutes of testimony from you, and then Representative Moline will give us some comments, and then members, we should have at least 10 minutes for questions. If we have a number of question members, we will come back again tomorrow.
Mr. Chair.
Assistant Commissioner, go ahead.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rebecca Flood. I'm Assistant Commissioner for Water Policy at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and I very much appreciate the opportunity to testify before you here today. In 2011, the legislature directed the PCA to undertake a number of activities related to wild rice, as you've heard. Today, I'd like to explain PCA's progress to date on that 2011 legislation. I'll also explain the status of our work toward revision of a wild rice sulfate standard. And finally, I want to highlight the unintended consequences of House File 1000. So in 2011, the legislature passed language requiring the Pollution Control Agency action on the issue of wild rice and water quality. And specifically, the 2011 legislation charged the PCA with creating a wild rice sulfate study advisory group to help design scientific research protocol to look at the impacts of sulfate and other factors on wild rice. Five of the testifiers that you've heard this morning are from groups that sit on that advisory group. Reviewing all the wild rice research and consulting with DNR to form a research plan. Another task was to actually conduct the research, and then if the science supports it, to propose a revision of the existing sulfate standard for wild rice waters. The goal of the 2011 bill was to inform a proposal regarding the sulfate standard and to develop criteria and a list of wild rice waters to clarify where the standard applies. We have been diligently working to complete these tasks, and let me just quickly review what we've done since the 2011 legislation. So in 2011, we established the advisory group, began contracting and work orders, and began literature review. In 2012, we, in addition to project management, initiated field surveys, continued existing data review and analysis. 2013, we continued those field surveys. We had researchers conduct hydroponics experiments and sulfide measurement development and container studies. In 2014, we assessed the findings from those 2 years of studies, undertook a peer review using an international panel of experts, and here in 2015, we're completing those additional evaluations stemming from the peer review, and we anticipate a final draft at the end of March of this year. We expect that the process, we've observed that the process has taken longer than we had originally anticipated when the 2011 legislation passed. While we fully knew and realized that the science of the matter is complicated, it certainly has proved out to be more complicated than what we even initially anticipated. We expect to have a draft proposal for a revision of the sulfate standard for wild rice, along with criteria and a listing of wild rice waters, completed as soon as the end of March. One of the elements that I wanted to highlight here too is that there are two primary differences with the in 2011 anticipated schedule that was reported, contained in a report to the legislature in our interim report in 2011. We added that peer review step that was not originally in the schedule. We included that earlier in the analysis in order to foster sound science and dialogue and transparency. And then we also merged the criteria and the listing process with the standard development discussion. And the reason why we did that is that we found as we were moving forward that trying to discuss what waters are noted as identified as wild rice waters, when we started to talk about that in an informal way, people were asking what the standard was. When we started talking about what the standard was, people were asking where the standard applied. So in order to reduce and eliminate, hopefully eliminate confusion, we saw that there was a need to move both of those processes in parallel. And so that's the path that we're on. Developing a proposal that addresses both the standard as well as the criteria for listing waters and a draft list of waters, as well as a permitting strategy, is the best way to move forward with this issue in a transparent and inclusive manner. Throughout this process, the Pollution Control Agency has strived to meet the provisions of the 2011 legislation, protect our state grain, and recognize the needs of concerns of permitted facilities, harvesters, and tribal members. Being open and transparent and involving an advisory committee and other interested stakeholders takes time, as I'm sure you're all aware. The MPCA has strong concerns that the adoption of House File 1000 could lead to some unintended consequences regarding water permitting. The context of the federal-state relationship around water law is really very important to understanding these consequences. As mentioned previously, the Federal Clean Water Act gives the federal government, the EPA, the oversight authority over every state that issues federal permits, otherwise known as National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System permits, or NPDES permits. If the EPA objects to a permit that a state is planning to issue, regardless of what the issue is, the state cannot move forward with the issuance of that permit. In 2011, the legislature considered a bill similar to House File 1000, and EPA is on record via their May 2011 letter to reaffirm their authority to object to permits. This 2011 correspondence, I believe, is included in the members' packets. What this 2011 EPA letter means is that if House File 1000 is enacted and MPCA is prohibited from addressing the wild rice sulfate standard in permits until rule revisions are adopted, EPA may exercise its authority to object to any such permits, and those permits therefore could not move forward. Given that we anticipate that a rulemaking could take 2 years or more once there's a public notice of the draft rule list and criteria and permitting strategy, then we launch into the administrative procedures process that would also include what I would anticipate we would be requested to conduct a contested case hearing with an administrative law judge. And that process, in other circumstances and other rulemakings, can take 2 years or more for us to complete. Given that time frame, no such permits for new construction, expansion, or modification of any facilities, whether they are municipal treatment systems, industrial facilities, agricultural facilities, or mines, if they are upstream of a wild rice water that require a federal permit, those would not be able to be issued. This delay of up to 2 years will slow down the entire permitting process at a potentially significant cost to permittees at a time when the legislature has established goals for permit timeliness. So in closing, Mr. Chair, thank you for the opportunity to provide our concerns about unintended consequences stemming from House File 1000 and to update the committee on our progress toward fulfilling the 2011 wild rice legislation, and we're happy to stand for questions.
Well, thank you, Assistant Commissioner Flood. You're the only one that overran that much of anybody's allotted time. So you had a lot to say, but thank you for what you had to say. Ms. Lothammer, do you have anything, a few seconds to add, or are you good to go?
Mr. Chair, no. I was just going to say it was my fault for underestimating how much time it would take.
Well, you do a great job. Representative Moline, if you want to
let us know your thoughts
at this point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I want to make a few comments before we get to questions quickly. The first being, I just want for public record that I did not intend to disrespect anybody by bringing this legislation forward. We have always involved the tribes in this process. They were specifically written into the 2011 laws, having a very important voice. We've met with the tribes on the range. I know U.S. Steel has met with them. We certainly would echo your comments, Mr. Chair, that we feel like those are very valuable considerations and valuable input. So I just want to personally say that I did not intend to disrespect anybody by bringing this bill forward. And I do.
Lean, I never heard anything along those lines, so thank you for clarifying.
I do sincerely apologize if that did occur. I'm sorry for that. Mr. Chair, I just want to point out that even those who oppose my bill did not say that 10 should be the standard, that 10 is the number, because frankly there's no justification for the number 10 given current research on the matter. And that's the point of the bill, and that's my concern, is that the MPCA is still going to be imposing a 10 standard for at least the next 2 years, despite the fact that there is no basis or justification for that standard. If you look at the conclusions in a 2013 report that Dr. Pastor prepared for the MPCA, he says in his conclusions, sulfate did not affect either seed germination or seedling growth other than a slight depression of root legs at extremely high concentrations, 1,600 milligrams of sulfates per liter. We've heard several testifiers mention sulfides. We do not have a sulfide standard in Minnesota. There's no sulfide standard adopted into the Clean Water Act. We are talking about regulating sulfates, and the research shows that the sulfate levels can far exceed 10 before they have any detrimental impact on wild rice, and that's our concern, that that standard will continue to be applied. Furthermore, as Representative Dill had alluded to in opening comments, this rule went 47 years without being enforced. 47 years without anybody coming forward and wanting this rule to be enforced. This rule came about because people wanted to stop polymet and non-ferrous mining. I mean, that's, we should just get that out there. That's why this was brought to the MPCA's attention, and that's why it's been enforced. You didn't hear any non-ferrous mining operations testify today because they can meet the standard. They use a lot less water. This issue isn't just about mining, but obviously, you know, we've gone down that route. As you see from the map, it impacts industry statewide. It impacts municipalities statewide, but it does impact our mining facilities. Non-ferrous mining can meet the 10. The 10 standard is going to bring down our taconite industry. And Mr. Chair, I don't say that lightly. I'm not one personally to think that industry shouldn't be regulated or shouldn't be taxed. In fact, you know, Mr. Sutherland went through all those millions of dollars of taxes that the mining companies paid. I actually increased their taxes by over $2 million a year 2 years ago. I believe in taxing them. I believe in regulations. HIBTAC is in my district. We were having some issues with blasting and homeowners complaining that their homes were being impacted by blasting. I went to Cliffs and I said, you need to change your blasting patterns because I'm getting complaints from homeowners. You know, they hired engineers and they were meeting the current standards, but I went back to them again and I said, I'm still getting complaints. And to their credit, they spent money to change their blasting patterns to have less of an impact on homeowners, despite the fact that they were meeting state regulations. So I'm not one to say that industry shouldn't be regulated or shouldn't be taxed and that it's going to drive it out of our state. But the fact of the matter is, this is different. Just yesterday, I found out that 50 workers in my district in Keewatin at Magnetation and AK Steel are out of work due to the global market in iron ore. 50 people out of a job. You know, I hope that's not just the tip of the iceberg, but the fact of the matter is, you know, our taconite industry will be brought down by this 10 standard, and all we're asking for is sound science. All we're asking for is rulemaking and a fairness and predictability in the market, Mr. Chair. So I just wanted to get those comments on the record before we go to questions.
Thank you. Assistant Commissioner Flood, did you say that you will be getting us a list of waters in the next month? Did I hear you say, and I'm wondering when was that publicly known that you were going to do that?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we're in the process of finalizing the packet that is would include the potential standard for wild rice, what's appropriate for that, a list of waters that are going to be proposed as wild rice waters, the criteria for how we determine what are wild rice waters, as well as a permitting strategy moving forward. That should be available as early as the end of March.
And Ms. Flood, Commissioner Flood, when did you make that information known to us?
I believe that was more publicly announced about a week ago.
Okay. Thank
Ms.
you.
Ms. Lothammer.
To that point, Representative Moline.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to that point, and I did speak with the MPCA yesterday, you know, the problem is they come out with a draft list of the waters, and then it goes through basically a two-year review period. So what the MPCA informed me of yesterday is it will be the summer of 2017 or early 2018 before the wild rice standard and water is finalized by the Citizens Board and adopted by the EPA. Until that time, until the summer of 2017 or early 2018, they will continue to apply the 10 standard. And the waters will not be finalized yet because the rule wouldn't have been adopted by the EPA.
Thank you, Representative Lee.
Thank you,
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Assistant Commissioner Flood, just a couple of things. You talked early in your presentation about peer review and how the working the advisory group on this has been submitting their science for peer review. Can you explain a little bit more about that process, please?
Commissioner Flood.
Members of the committee and Representative Fabian, what we have been, what Representative Moline identified as Dr. Pastor's study is just one of the studies that we've conducted as a part of this research on the wild rice standard, and certainly Director Lothammer can give you a little bit more detail on that, but there's a number of other different research evaluations that we've been conducting. That information has all come together, been evaluated and compiled by our scientists, and at that point we submitted that information to an international panel of experts to give us their recommendations and identify where we might do additional evaluations to strengthen what we were looking at as things that might affect the growth of wild rice. So
follow-up, Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, with regards to the peer review, is that something that you just choose to do internally, or are you obligated to do that by statute?
Director Lothammer, if you could identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Shannon Lothammer. I'm the Director of the Environmental Analysis and Outcomes Division at the Pollution Control Agency. And to the question about peer review is actually always a process in our water quality standards development and revision efforts. Typically what happens is when we're proposing a new standard or proposing changes to a standard, we rely on scientific publications, which as a part of the publication process goes through an independent peer review process. And we rely on that science to help explain and justify and bring together the proposal. In the case of the wild rice sulfate standard work, this was a study that the PCA conducted itself. And given the timing and the interest in moving forward as quickly as possible, we recognized that the results of the studies were not going to be through that typical scientific publication process before we would want to rely on that information to make recommendations. And that's why the PCA chose to conduct a peer review process. We actually contracted with a company called Eastern Research Group that does peer review. That's part of their base. They're an independent company. They do a lot of work for EPA, for the Office of Management and Budget on the federal level, and for other states. So they conducted the peer review process in order to keep that independence. We provided criteria for the types of expertise that we thought would be important to have on the peer review panel. It was a public process for nominating potential peer reviewers, and it went from there.
Thank you. We're going to bring PCA back tomorrow morning first thing, but I want to know if Representative Purcell, Representative Hausman, or Representative Johnson have questions for any of the testifiers. I would imagine most of the testifiers came a long distance to be here. Does anyone have any questions? The longest we can stay in this room is until 5 after. Does anybody have any questions for any of the testifiers that they wanted them to speak to? Representative Purcell for MPCA, is it? Okay. Representative Hausman, is it for MPCA? Or?
No, I was hoping
Representative Hausman.
I was hoping Representative Purcell would have his opportunity. He's the scientist.
Representative Purcell, I'm going to bring MPCA back tomorrow morning. I'm going to bang the gavel at 5 after. So if someone has questions for the testifiers that are not MPCA. Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I maybe it's good to get a couple of things out. I don't have specific questions for these testifiers. There's been comments that have been made throughout the hearing here this morning and about what sound science. And let me say, first of all, you look at this map. See that big blob of green right in the middle up on the top? That's my district. That's my district. A lot of wild rice on Leech Lake, okay? And on the Leech Lake Reservation. And one of the things that's missing here, I believe, is we're talking about an ecosystem that supports fisheries, of course, ricing, waterfowl. So tourism in Minnesota, $14 billion a year industry. What's wild rice? Millions of dollars. So this is something where we do need to get it right, and I appreciate the opportunity, Mr. Chair and Representative Moline, to discuss this bill. And it was said the standard of 10 isn't justified of sulfate. Well, what happens when sulfate is in the ecosystem? We need to talk about the ecosystem, just like we talk about farm ecosystem. Why don't we put straight nitrogen on the farm or straight phosphorus on beans or corn? Because it's going to burn the bejesus out of it. And that's the same thing that's going to happen if we do this, if we put sulfate in a wild rice ecosystem and it turns to sulfide and then the rice can't grow. So the ecosystem concept, and I will say more about that when I have another opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Purcell. Representative Moline, are you available tomorrow morning if we came at the beginning of the time? I understand one of our bills tomorrow may not end up on the agenda. I'm not sure on that, but I think we could conceivably bring you back and MPCA and allow a half hour of questions. I think there's a number of members that have questions. Are you available tomorrow morning?
Mr. Chair, if you need me to be available, I will be available.
Representative Moline, Representative Metza could sit in for you too if it doesn't work. Our Representative Dill is here on the committee, so Representative Dill could certainly sit in for you. with no problem. Representative Hansen, and then we're going to... I'm sorry. Representative Hornstein, did you have a question for one of the testifiers?
Sure, yeah.
Representative Hornstein.
Quick.
Is that okay?
Either for maybe Ms. LaDuke or...
Ms. LaDuke, if you could come down.
There.
Go ahead, Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, and thank you for your testimony. We've heard several different people mention this idea that indigenous nations were consulted through this process, that there was this consultation happening. What was the nature of that? I mean, were you consulted? What do you know about this? Because, you know, I don't know what consultation means if decisions were already made.
Ms. LaDuke.
I actually do not know exactly the extent. I know that I did talk to the Fond du Lac band, and I did talk some to the Mille Lacs band, and they didn't feel too comfortable with what was going on down here. So I don't know what constitutes consultation in the mind of industry or in the mind of the representative here, but I do not feel that our bands felt that this was a process that they were comfortable with.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
And Representative Hornstein, I'm not talking about in the past. I'm talking about going forward. I want this resolved. I want it to work, and we're going to find a way to do it, and you're going to be involved in the process.
Can you help me with my blood pressure?
Ms. LaDuke, you and I both are blessed with low blood pressure, and I want us to keep it that way.
Okay,
members, we'll be back tomorrow morning. We're adjourned.